Good evening, Ketchikan and Southern Southeast Alaska. Welcome to Book Talk. My name is Charlotte Glover, and I'll be your host for the next half hour, bringing you the best in books from the Ketchikan Public Library. Good evening and welcome to Book Talk for Thursday, February the 2nd, and it's lovely to see it warming up outside here, the Rock Pit Studios of KRBD, and watching the new library being built. Very, very fun. We've got our February calendar out now. You know we are online at www.firstcitylibraries.org. We also have a Facebook page at Ketchikan Public Library if you're a Facebook fan. And you can get direct emails in your mailbox by giving us your email address at the desk. We do not sell it to anyone else. It's destroyed as soon as it's entered into our system, which will send you personal emails about our events. And also, we have a second email system for overdue library books. One of the fun features of that system is that you get a notice 3 days before something is due, giving you ample time to renew the item if you want. You can also renew online at firstcitylibraries.org or give us a call at the library. So we're doing everything we can to be interactive 24 hours a day to help you keep track of your library items. And Lord knows we need that at my house. We are always, always misplacing library materials. So if you see that big Nate book anywhere, that would be ours. That's the current missing item. There's always something, and they always show up. That's what I tell people at the library desk. Relax. They always show up. I had a family recently replace a movie. They had lost a library item, and the mom came in last week and said sheepishly that the movie was in their computer disk drive. They hadn't thought to look there. I mean, naturally, who would if you don't typically sit at your computer and watch a movie? But in my experience, there's always, always a story behind lost items at the library. Well, one thing that's not lost at the library is the February calendar, and we do have a couple of teen advisory group meetings in February. One is Monday night the 6th at 6 p.m. and Saturday the 25th at 2 p.m. So if you are a teen age 13 to 19, you'd like to help plan library events and do volunteer work at the library, TAG might be just the group for you. And we've had lots of Head Start action. We've got Saxman Head Start coming regularly, and Ketchikan Head Start has started coming. So story times are busy, busy. Public story times are Thursdays and Fridays at 10:30 a.m., pretty much for all ages. If you're home during the daytime and want to bring the kids, come on down. The teens are also hosting a My Dead Valentine event for kids teens on the 10th at 6:30. They're going to be watching Tim Burton's The Corpse Bride that night and, of course, having sweet treats. On the 11th, we're just going to have drop-in Valentines for all ages. We'll set up the supplies. You provide the inspiration and the artistic creation. Pretty simple, but we've got some great colorful papers and stickers and art supplies to help you make your own Valentines, because that's coming up on the 14th. The library will be closed 3 days for inventory in February, the 15th, 16th, and 17th. It's just such a big project. We'd rather just get it done and come back to you with a refreshed library. We were shelf reading today in the children's library. What does that mean? It means we check to see that the books are in order. Part of what you find is books shoved behind shelves, or books that belong in a different section, books that belong in the adult library, down in children's, etc. Inventory helps with some of those things, but our current inventory system isn't very good at telling us if something's misshelved, and so we find it helps to have the personal touch and just get out there and dig a little bit. Plus, it makes the library look really nice. And on the 18th, we're going to make one of my personal favorites, Frito pie. Have been eating that since I was a little girl because in New Mexico, it's kind of traditional to rip open a bag of Fritos and put some green chili stew on there with some cheese and onions. Traditional meal at Woolworth's on the plaza in Santa Fe for generations. But in Ketchikan, we're going to do it a little bit differently. We're going to make Emeril Lagasse's chili and show kids how to layer that with Fritos and cheese and sour cream and onion, whatever you like. Anyway, one of my childhood favorites. Basically, a good excuse to whip up a pot of chili in the library and have some yummy tastes. And then our family night is the 23rd on boating safety with the Coast Guard. Remember, that's your free pizza dinner, free book for your preschooler, and a literacy program that is aimed at our families with young children, say about 7 and under. After 7, they would just be bored. But we welcome everyone on the 23rd, but you must get a free ticket in advance because space is limited. And that limits the fire marshal, not us. The fire marshal wants us to be safe, and so you've got to pick up a ticket in advance. Garden Club on the 27th, and then we're looking forward to author Snead Colliard doing a slideshow and book signing on the 29th from his travels around the world. It's going to be fabulous. Well, I'm going to keep the focus on books for young people for another week or so because that's what collection I'm digging around in right now, getting ready for inventory. And I'm also just reading such random stuff at home. Started a big biography of Margaret Bourke White this week that I probably won't do for book talk because it's an interlibrary loan book, but it's definitely taking some time to read. It's a little bit too much of a book. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes you get one of those books where it's too much information, and that's that book. But I found this fabulous article about A Wrinkle in Time today and thought we would pay homage to the great Madeleine L'Engle. This is by Pamela Paul. Bookish girls tend to mark phases of their lives by periods of intense literary character identification. Schoolgirls of the 70s had their Deanie and Sally J. Friedman and Margaret moments, muddling through adolescence in the guise of one Judy Blume heroine or another. And for almost a century and a half, girls have fluctuated between seasons of Amy and Meg and Joe March, imagining themselves alternately with blonde corkscrew curls, eldest sister's wisdom, or writerly ambitions. But for those who came of age any time during the past half century, the most startling transformation occurred upon reading Madeleine L'Engle's Newbery Medal-winning classic, A Wrinkle in Time, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. It was under L'Engle's influence that we willed ourselves to be like Meg Murray, the awkward girl who suffered through flyaway hair, braces, and glasses, but who was also, and to a much greater degree, concerned with the extent of her own intelligence, the whereabouts of her missing scientist father, the looming threat of conformity, and ultimately the fate of the universe. Meg Murray, in short, was a departure from the typical girl's book protagonist, as wonderful as many of those varied characters are. Meg was a heroine of science fiction. In 1962, when A Wrinkle in Time, after 26 rejections, was acquired by John Farrar Stragiro, science fiction by women and aimed at female readers was a rarity. The genre was thought to be downmarket and not up to the standard of children's literature, the stuff of pulp and comic books for errant schoolboys. Even today, girls and grown women are not generally fans. When Joanna Russ, one of the few successful female science fiction writers, died last year, her obit said she was a writer who helped deliver science fiction into the hands of the most alien creatures the genre had yet seen, women. A Wrinkle in Time, the first in a trilogy that was later extended to include two more books, also defied the norm. Although a major crossover success with boys as well as girls, with more than 10 million copies sold to date, the book has especially won over girls, and it usually reaches them at a particularly pivotal moment of pre-adolescence when they are actively seeking to define themselves, their ambitions, and their place in the world. Part of what made it seem so liberating to so many girls is that it allowed those with an analytic mind and an interest in the pursuit of science to read about a subject that, as at a time, was not perceived as a suitable course of study for girls, said Leonard Marcus, author of a biography of Lengel, Searching for Madeline, to be published this fall. At the same time, at its core, it's about a girl's love for her father. A Wrinkle in Time follows three children as they cross the barriers of time and space via something called a tesseract. On a dark and stormy night, Mrs. What's-It, a celestial being disguised as an old woman, visits Meg, her brother, and her younger brother, Charles Wallace. Soon Meg and Charles Wallace, a prodigy of some sort, and Calvin O'Keefe, a high school boy, are tesseracting across the universe in search of Meg's father. They encounter at various points Mrs. Who and Mrs. Witch, who, along with Mrs. What's-It, are also enigmatic star creatures. But it's Meg, a girl who combines both the ordinary and the extraordinary, who overcomes the book's villain, an evil disembodied brain called It, with the power of simple human emotion, love. Perhaps it's this softer element that distinguishes Wrinkle from its rocketry and lightsaber brethren, but it doesn't make the book any less weighty or challenging. In her introduction to a 2007 edition, Anna Quindlen, an enthusiast since childhood, confessed, "The truth is, I'm not a fan of science fiction, and my math and physics gene has always been weak." Lengel's book shies away from neither topic. On meeting Meg, we learn she can perform square root functions in her head, a mark not of wallflower status, but of moral distinction. Still, Meg harbors doubts about her own intellectual abilities, and her exacting expectations rub off on the reader. If anything, the book enchants readers who might not entirely grasp its contents with the delight in not knowing, the realization that even the most know-it-all kids do not, in fact, have all the answers, and that certain questions are worth asking. I loved Mrs. Who's cryptic questions and the math that went right over my head and the fact that Charles Wallace had powers I was always struggling to understand, said Rebecca Steed, whose Newbery Medal-winning novel When You Reach Me was in great part an homage to A Wrinkle in Time. Lengel, who was born in 1918 and grew up a child of privilege in New York City, struggled academically at her private school, though she later graduated cum laude from Smith. She first got the idea for A Wrinkle in Time after reading Einstein's writings on relativity. "I used a lot of those principles to make a universe that was creative and yet believable," she said in an interview with her publisher before her death in 2007. Of course, science fiction is not only about science. It's also often deeply informed by politics and can be a vehicle for commentary on the complex effects of progress in all its permutations. Russ, for an example, a graduate of Yale, wrote books infused with feminist messages and digressions on philosophy. A Wrinkle in Time can be read as a warning against communism. Lengel, an active liberal Episcopalian who spent many of her later years as a writer in residence at the Church of the St. John and Divine in New York, tended to write allegorical works which, as in the books of C.S. Lewis, good inevitably triumphs over evil, a message as likely to appeal to girls as to boys. So what is it that makes girls averse to science fiction? Could it be pronounced boyness of the covers? The same signal that deters girls from switching to Superman after the Betty and Veronica days have passed? Science fiction books, whether technologically elaborate, intergalactic stories, or the so-called soft science fiction, often wear dark washes of black and navy blue with 3D fonts and brutal images of fire and destruction. Yet there isn't anything inherently unfeminine about science fiction. Some might say the dystopic fantasy, apocalyptic tales, and paranormal romance so popular with today's teenage girls are actually couched girl-friendly variants of science fiction. Perhaps, but why should science fiction proper be any less welcoming to girls? It may be simplistic to suggest that reading science fiction will lead women to pursue careers in chemistry and quantum physics and information technology, but then how many female authors say they were inspired to become writers because of Jo from Little Women? Surely we don't mean to imply that science fiction or science is really just for boys. It is, after all, Meg's microbiologist mother, Catherine Murray, rather than her rescued father, who later in the series wins the Nobel Prize. So, wow, 50 years of A Wrinkle in Time, hard to imagine. I read that book over and over growing up. I did not understand a lot of it until I was older, but I understood Meg And I liked Meg, and I liked her book reading family, and I liked the stories of her friends in the Austin Family Trilogy. And if you've got a smart girl in your life, you definitely have to introduce her to A Wrinkle in Time. But great boy characters, too. These books are timeless. They're ageless. They're 50 years old. Yes, and she really did get rejected over and over and over again. She and Madeline L'Engle tells great stories about perseverance if you're going to be an author. Taking a look at the bestseller list, incredibly loud and extremely loud and incredibly close is selling very, very well because of the Tom Hanks film that's out right now. Same with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and The Help. So people obviously watch the movie and read the book. The Girl Who Played with Fire, Stieg Larsson at 4, Private Number 1 Suspect, James Patterson at 5, American Gods, Neil Gaiman at 6, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest at 7. This is the New York Times book review, by the way. I was spending some time this week with the Times. 11-22-63, Stephen King at 8, The Litigators, John Grisham at 9, and Jennifer McMahon's Island of Lost Girls, a kidnapping stirs memories in a woman whose childhood best friend disappeared at number 10. What's happening over in children's chapter books? The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, getting so much acclaim at number 1. The Invention of Hugo Cabret, Brian Selznick at 2. Rick Riordan's The Son of Neptune at 3. Ransom Riggs and Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children at 4. I love, love, love the cover on that book. So attractive. The Lego Ideas book by Daniel Lipkowitz at 5. Through My Eyes by Tim Tebow with Nathan Whittaker. The Quarterback's Journey Rooted in His Christian Faith. Everything on It, Shel Silverstein at 7. Wonderstruck, Brian Selznick at 8. The Lost Hero by Rick Riordan at 9. And Hallowed by Cynthia Hand at 10. And then children's series books, The Hunger Games. We had more adults coming in this week for that book. And I need to get some more copies before the movie hits. I'm sure I could have 5 copies checked out right now. And district-wide, I think there's 35 or 40 copies of The Hunger Games checked out across Ketchikan, which is amazing. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Jeff Kinney at number 2. Inheritance, Christopher Paolini. So obviously this is total sales of just the genre, the brand. Magic Treehouse, number 4. Percy Jackson, 5. Bad Kitty books are selling well at 6, followed by Dork Diaries, Pretty Little Liars, 39 Clues, and Big Nate. If you're not familiar with those books and you have kids, come on down and get to know the current crop of children's books. You know, children always live in two worlds when it comes to reading. They live in the world of favorites that their parents loved and their teachers have introduced them to, but they always have their own literature for their generation. I was just cleaning out some teen books today and was reminded of that about every 10 years there's a turnover in which authors are hot for teenagers. Not to say they won't read The Chocolate War or Wrinkle in Time or some of the classics, but if you really want them to be eager readers, you got to keep up with what's fresh and new, especially if you work with kids or in education. Well, we talked last week about award winners in the book world for young people, and I wanted to take some time to look at audiobooks, both for purchasing ideas and also to share with you what has won awards this year. We don't purchase audiobooks as frequently as we buy books and movies. Some of that's just a shelving conundrum. We don't have a lot of space for audiobooks, and they don't check out quite as much. But they are very, very popular in our library. And if you haven't tried an audiobook, I'd really encourage you to give it a try. I came late to the party. I really did. I've never been a great oral learner. I'm a reader through and through, but I got some of our playaways that we give little lariats for in the children's library so they can hang around your neck, and started listening to them at the rec center when I was exercising or taking walks. And boy, did the time fly. Just so much fun and so interesting to hear a story. A lot of people in town who are woodworkers or quilters. I know some fishermen. I know people that live out north that commute into town. There's always a time and place in your life that you can fit in an audiobook if you want. And I've heard more than one story of cars idling in the driveway while people are listening to the end of the chapter. So audiobooks are made for young children nowadays, for readers of all ages, for adults, of course. And just with everything else, the American Library Association has an award for best audio, and it's called the Odyssey Award. And this year, the winner is Rotters, written by Daniel Krauss, narrated by Kirby Hebro, produced by Listening Library, which is one of the big producers of books for young people. I don't even know what that book is. I haven't heard of it. Ghetto Cowboy, written by Gene Neary, was an audio honor book. Okay for Now, written by Gary Schmidt. Yes, that one I'm familiar with, and that's another Listening Library one. The Scorpio Races, Maggie Stiefvater, that just won the Newbery Honor. Okay for Now just won the Newbery Honor. Well, they're loving the audiobooks as well. And Young Friedel by Cynthia Voigt, narrated by Wendy Carter. So these are books that we will get on audio then right away, that I'll put them into my February order. And you can look forward to us having the Odyssey Award winners. Now, there's other top 10 lists in the country, and there are committees all the time with the American Library Association that are looking for the best audiobooks. And you can Google Best Audio for Young Adults or ALA Audio. Winners in 2011 included The Best Bad Luck I Ever Had by Kristen Levine, read by Kitty Hayborn. And the readers are just as important as the authors to audiobook fans, by the way. They love the readers. Dream Dark Silk Singer by Lonnie Taylor, Finnegan of the Rock by Melina Marchetta, The Knife of Never Letting Let Go by Patrick Ness, Muchado by Lou Ann Johnson, One Crazy Summer by Rita Garcia Williams, Precious by Sapphire, Rapture of the Deep by L.A. Meyer, and The Rock and the River by Keila Magoon. Now, these titles are really, really different than what you're going to find on a bestseller list or even an award-winning list, because they're looking for great storytelling and great audio quality. And again, this helps inform me when I'm making purchasing decisions. Of this list, top 10 amazing audiobooks for young adults, I brought one today, One Crazy Summer by Rita Garcia Williams, about Delphine and her sisters who fly to Oakland to meet their mother who abandoned them, only to be foisted off on the Black Panther community. So Sissy Aisha Johnson is convincing as the young Delphine, conveying the emotional impact of the historical novel. So this is basically set in the 1960s in Oakland, California. Give you a taste of how audiobooks work. This is One Crazy Summer by Rita Garcia Williams. And before we start that, too, let me just say, with our Listen Alaska program, you can download a lot of these onto your personal listening device or your computer through your library card link, and we can help you with that at the library. But this is, again, One Crazy Summer by Rita Garcia Williams.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of One Crazy Summer by Rita Williams Garcia, narrated by C.C. Aisha Johnson.
Cassius Clay Clouds. Good thing the plane had seat belts and we'd been strapped in tight before takeoff. Without them, that last jolt would have been enough to throw Vonetta into orbit and Fern across the aisle. Still, I anchored myself and my sisters best as I could to brace us for whatever came next. Those clouds weren't through with us yet and dealt another Cassius Clay left and right jab to the body of our Boeing 727. Vonetta shrieked, then stuck her thumb in her mouth. Fern bit down on Miss Patty Cake's pink plastic arm. I kept my whimper to myself. It was bad enough my insides squeezed in and stretched out like a monkey grinder's accordion. No need to let anyone know how frightened I was. I took a breath so when my mouth finally opened, I'd sound like myself and not like some scared rabbit. "It's just the clouds bumping," I told my sisters. "Like they bumped over Detroit and Chicago and Denver." Vonetta pulled her thumb out of her mouth and put her head in her lap. Fern held on to Miss Patty Cake. They listened to me. "We push our way up in the clouds. The clouds get mad and push back. Like you and Fern fighting over red and gold crowns." I didn't know about clouds fighting and pushing for a fact, but I had to tell my sister something. As long as Vonetta kept her fear to one shriek and Fern kept hers to biting Miss Patty Cake, I kept on spinning straw, making everything all right. That's mainly what I do. Keep Vonetta and Fern in line. The last thing Pa and Big Ma wanted to hear was how we made a grand Negro spectacle of ourselves 30,000 feet up in the air around all these white people. "You know how Papa is," I told them. "No way he'd put us on a plane if it were dangerous." They halfway believed me. Just as I had that soft plastic arm out of Fern's mouth, those Cassius Clay fighting clouds threw our 727 another jab. Big Ma, that's Pa's mother, still says Cassius Clay. Pa says Muhammad Ali or just Ali. I slide back and forth from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, whatever picture comes to mind. With Cassius Clay, you hear the clash of fists, like the plane getting jabbed and punched. With Muhammad Ali, you see a mighty mountain greater than Everest, and can't no one knock down a mountain. All the way to the airport, Pa had tried to act like he was dropping off 3 sacks of wash at the laundromat. I'd seen through Pa. He's no Vonetta putting on performances. He has only 1 or 2 faces, nothing hidden, nothing exaggerated. Even though it had been his idea that we fly out to Oakland to see Cecile, Pa'd never once said how exciting our trip would be. He just said that seeing Cecile was something whose time had come, that it had to be done. Just because he decided it was time for us to see her didn't mean he wanted us to go. My sisters and I had stayed up practically all night, California dreaming about what seemed like the other side of the world. We saw ourselves riding wild waves on surfboards, picking oranges and apples off fruit trees, filling our autograph books with signatures from movie stars we'd seen in soda shops. Even better, we saw ourselves going to Disneyland. We had watched airplanes lift up and fly off into blue sky as we neared the airport. Every time another airliner flew overhead, leaving a trail of white and gray smoke, Big Ma fanned herself and asked, "Jesus, why?" Big Ma had kept quiet long enough. Once inside the terminal, she let it all hang out. She told Pa, "I don't mind saying it, but this isn't right. Coming out to Idlewild and putting these girls on a plane so Cecile can see what she left behind. If she wants to see, let her get on an airplane and fly out to New York."
So you get a sense right there of how magnificent the readers are in audiobooks. And this is just a taste of One Crazy Summer by Rita Garcia Williams, and the reader there is Cece Asha Johnson. And again, well, no wonder I keep saying it wrong, because it's wrong on the press release. Rita Williams Garcia, there we go. I thought I was making stuff up there. Anyway, the book says Rita Williams Garcia, and that's what the narrator said, so my press release is wrong. My apologies there. We have lots of audio at the library for you to choose from, or through our Listen Alaska program online. And there'll be more to come in the new year.